Taking Stock on Newstalk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.
You're listening to Newstalk's Taking Stock. We're joined now by John Turner, Professor of Finance and Financial History at Queen's University Belfast and co-author of Boom and Bust, A Global History of Financial Bubbles. John, you're very welcome. Thanks for joining us.
No problem, Vincent.
This great book that you've written with your colleague William Quinn, you've roamed over far and wide over continents and centuries of some of the 10 big historical bubbles, some of which we've heard of, some of which we haven't. But I think you've challenged the notion we all have about financial bubbles, that it was down to the sheer irrationality of the investors who were duped at the time. I think you're challenging that, and you're saying there is a constant framework here, the bubble triangle that determines how all of these bubbles over time and over regions develop.
Yes, thanks for having me on your show, Vincent. The bubble triangle is really the central organizing theme of the book. And the bubble triangle is akin to the fire triangle in chemistry. So for a fire, you need heat, you need oxygen, and you need fuel, and then you need some sort of external spark to set it all off. And so it is with bubbles. And so what we observe with these bubbles across continents and across time, there's three constants. The first constant is speculation. So you see throughout these historical bubbles, lots of novices getting involved in buying, whether that be houses or whether that be property or whether that be stocks and shares. The second side of this bubble triangle is the fuel or the money and credit. So this is where, with low interest rates, people are reaching for yield. So they're reaching into riskier assets or buying riskier assets. And with credit, it's when we lower credit standards and it's cheap to borrow, then you get people actually borrowing to buy the bubble asset. Again, whether that be a house or whether that be stocks or shares. And then the third side of this bubble triangle is the oxygen. And this is the marketability of the underlying asset, the ease with which assets can be bought and sold. And over time, it's become a lot easier to buy and sell stocks on stock markets. It's become a lot easier to buy and sell property. And this increase in marketability is something that we really observe throughout time. So those are the three sides: speculation, marketability, money and credit. And then the external spark usually comes from politics, Vincent. That's usually the thing that sparks off these bubbles. A lot of bubbles across history have been deliberately engineered by governments. Some have been sparked almost as an aside from other policies. And the other thing then that we've found that sparks some bubbles across time is new technology, radical new technology that we really don't know how it's going to affect the economy. But this technology gets us excited and we start speculating in this new technology. So think internet shares, for example, back in the late 1990s. So that, in essence, is the bubble triangle that we outline in the book.
As you know, we on this island, particularly south of the border, John, are well used to boom and bust cycles and to all sorts of bubbles. But take our property bubble that we didn't suffer alone, obviously, 10, 12 years ago. Does that suggest that wasn't necessarily the fault of the banks, but ultimately driven by political policy that drove interest rates and other dynamics behind that?
Yeah. Yes. So one of the chapters in the book is the subprime bubble, and in that bubble we look at with Ireland, north and south, because in the north we had a similar sort of a boom and bust as you had in the south. And we look at the UK, we look at Spain, and look at the United States, and we ask, well, what was the common feature amongst these four economies that had these large housing booms and busts, and then suffered tremendous banking crises after that? And the one thing that links these four industrial democracies, it was their attitude towards how you provide social housing. In the rest of Europe and the rest of sort of the industrial world, social housing is largely provided by the state. But in these four economies, the decision was taken, back in the 1980s and into the 1990s, that to help the bottom quintiles of society, get their own house, we're going to deregulate the financial system and encourage the financial system, and in some cases almost force the financial system to lend to low-income borrowers so that they can get onto the housing market. So pressure comes on banks to lower their loan-to-asset values, to lower their loan-to-income ratios that they usually operated on. And so you get this tremendous drop in credit standards in the US, in Spain, in Ireland, in the UK, and that really then is what's driving it. So it's a political decision about how we want to provide social housing. And it's also got behind it this idea of, you know, the great inequality that we see in sort of Western democracies that's emerged over the past 20, 30 years. And our politicians thought that one way of trying to deal with that was to actually get more people to be property owners. And these four governments got addicted to the property boom that they experienced because, you know, property developers are paying taxes, banks are paying taxes, construction industry is paying taxes, and these, you know, the governments in these economies then are living off really high GDP, all the taxes coming in, and then they're able to fund, you know, things like education and health and other social goods as well.
Fascinating insights there into how the property and the housing bubble in particular developed in those jurisdictions, including our own, John, and let's hope we learn lessons from it. But looking back over all the bubbles that you've examined and you've set the necessary ingredients there and then the triggers that set them off, into all of that combustible kind of mix comes the impact of the media as well.
Yeah. the fourth estate. So it's really interesting when we look across these bubbles, the role of the media, because it ultimately depends on the incentives of the media. So in some of the bubbles we look at, you see newspapers wanting to develop them or sell themselves as having this reputation of being a purveyor of truth, an exposer of financial folly. So you see that in the 19th century, particularly with the likes of The Times or The Economist, when they were speaking out against something called the railway mania, which took place in the mid-1840s in the UK. And they had these large anti-bubble editorials going on. So they were really calling the bubbles and trying to prick the bubbles, if you like. Then sometimes, some of the bubbles, we observe venal journalism. And we particularly observe this when there's state control of the press. So one of the first bubbles we look at in the book is this Mississippi bubble, which took place in 1720. And despite the name, it actually took place in Paris. And the name of the company that people were speculating was the Mississippi Company. But the French press, the Parisian press, was state controlled. And it was basically puffing, you know, this bubble so that people would buy shares in this Mississippi company. And then more recently in China, so we have a chapter on the book on China, looking at bubbles in China in 2007 and 2015. And there again, the state controls the press, and the state were using the press to really push the bubbles and to push a bubble narrative. And then we also observe bubbles where the press's business model is being driven by advertising the bubble asset. So you typically find this in property bubbles. So one of the bubbles we look at is set in Australia in the 1880s. And again, the press play a huge role in driving this property bubble because they're carrying advertisements from property developers and people selling plots of land. And when you look at Ireland in the 2000s, you look at the UK, you look at Spain, you look at the United States, you see a lot of local newspapers, their business model, essentially because of the internet, had changed to carrying advertisements for, you know, property developers, carrying advertisements for house sales. And so those newspapers had no incentive to actually call the bubble and to call it out. And so it ultimately depends on the incentives that the press faces at the time of the bubble.
Yeah, property pornography, I think we termed it about 10 or 12 years ago. Our guest here on News Talk is John Turner, co-author of Boom and Bust, A Global History of Financial Bubbles. You range back as far as the one I think we all heard from in our school days, the South Sea Bubble, John. But you burst a bubble that I think many of us also have heard of in some way. And we thought it was quite an exotic bubble, the tulip bubble of, what, 1636, 1637 in Holland, which perhaps wasn't a bubble in the strict sense at all.
Yeah, so as you say, most people, when you mention the word bubble, possibly the first thing they think of is what was called the tulip mania, which took place in Holland in 1636. But when you actually look at this bubble, which was a bubble surrounding the exotic tulip bulbs, people buying and selling exotic tulip bulbs, there's very little evidence that this bubble actually took place. What was happening in Amsterdam at the time is that there were some people who thought the people paying high prices for these exotic tulip bulbs, this was just excessive. This was not right to do this. This was inappropriate. And so then you get these sort of satirical pieces being written about people paying high prices for these tulip bulbs. And then these satirical pieces are picked up by later authors, and they're misreported. They don't realize that it's satire, and so they report it as fact. And then into the English language, it comes in a famous book in 1843 was published, which basically really brings this tulip mania to the English-speaking world, and it's based on no evidence whatsoever, or very little evidence. And so that's the way it's come into the English language. And unfortunately, then every time there's a bubble, people talk about the tulips. So we totally dismiss this as even being a bubble in the book.
Well, let's hope the early media in Holland and since then weren't involved in fanning a mythological story. The book ranges over a whole range of fascinating bubbles from the South Sea bubble, as we said, through an Australian land boom bubble in the 19th century to the recent Chinese stock market bubbles. But one I had never heard of, at least, the British bicycle bubble of the 1890s.
Yeah, this is a fascinating bubble. So we think that what really sparked this bubble was radical new technology, and that radical new technology was the bicycle, the modern bicycle. So even by the 1880s, people were still riding the old penny farthing, the ridiculous bike with this huge front wheel, tiny rear wheel. And of course, it was notorious for accidents. People were so-called taking a header where you would come off this bicycle. There was also the bone shaker bicycle, so named because it shook every single bone in the human body. But in the late 1880s, we get the emergence of lots of new technology that allows the modern bicycle, the bicycle that we would recognize today, to emerge. So some of these things are the diamond frame, a chain, and pneumatic tires. And you put all of these three important things together and a bunch of other important technological inventions, then you've got this amazing new technology. And so round about the mid-1890s, you then get hundreds of bicycle manufacturers, mainly based in Birmingham and Coventry, but some based in Dublin, floating on the London Stock Exchange, raising capital in the London Stock Exchange to basically set up bicycle companies. So by the peak of the bubble in 1896, you have something like 600 plus bicycle companies listed on the London Stock Exchange and the Birmingham Stock Exchange and other stock exchanges around the UK. And the prices of these bicycle shares doubles in the space of a year. And then once the bubble collapses, roughly about 1896-97, bicycle shares collapse in price. So this is like an episode that most people haven't heard of. It's also an episode that we go on to describe as being a useful bubble, because not all bubbles are destructive. This was one example of a useful bubble, because a lot of the technology that was developed by these bicycle companies ends up in motorcycle companies, ends up in motor cars. So a lot of the technology that these companies develop ends up in motor cars, and it even ends up in aeroplanes. Most people don't realize that the Wright brothers actually started off as bicycle manufacturers.
You say that not all bubbles are destructive, but we know that, and we know that some people actually make money from the mania that starts at the start of the cycle, get in and out, whether through good judgment or otherwise. But broadly speaking, these forms of bubbles are not good for economies or for the citizens who people those economies, John.
Yeah. So, again, one of the things we try and do in the book is try and understand what makes some bubbles more destructive than others. And there's two things that come together to make for various destructive bubbles in terms of destroying economic growth and destroying economies and destroying individuals' lives. And that's when the bubble is sparked by or engineered by governments, and when the banking system is heavily involved, when the banking system is lending money to help buy the bubble assets. So you think of the subprime bubble, so in the US, the UK, Ireland, Spain. You think of the Australian property bubble, which took place in the 1880s. This is the burst that Australia had after their property bubble lasted for, the depression lasted for like nearly two decades. It's the worst economic experience Australia has ever had in its history. Japan's another example. Its property and stock market bubble burst in 1990. And I remember as a student in 1990, people saying, oh, Japan's this wonderful place. And then I'm a lecturer by the year 2000. And, you know, we're talking about the lost decade in Japan. And then by the time we get to 2010, we're talking about the lost two decades in Japan because, you know, the destructive nature of its bubble. So, yeah, bubbles can be very destructive. But the two common themes that we find, you know, politics and banks.
Are we getting any better at predicting when these will happen, John, including with the help of your book? Or given, as you said earlier, that markets are becoming much more swift and prompt, and I suppose the impact of social media in terms of spreading rumour and all sorts of information, are we likely to see more and more of them?
Yeah, so one of the things we have observed in the book is that the time span between the first major bubble in the world and the second was almost 100 years. And then after that, the time between different bubbles shortened and shortened and shortened to the extent now that when we hit the 1990s, we're seeing a bubble, a major bubble in the economy every 6 to 7 years. So they are getting a lot more frequent. Now, are bubbles easy to predict? No. So this is one of the things that we spend a lot of time in the conclusion of the book talking, can we predict bubbles? And indeed, the most common question that I'm asked when people find out that I've written this book is, you know, when's the next bubble going to happen? How can we predict it? And so the answer that we'd normally give, or I normally give to that question, is, you know, going back to the three sides of the bubble triangle. Is there easy marketability? Is there a lot of, you know, marketability in the shares or in property? Is there a lot of speculation? Do we see a lot of novices entering the market? And then is it, what about money and credit? Are interest rates low? Is lending lax? So if I was looking at the market today, I would say marketability is very high because we've got fractional shares. So you want to buy a Tesla share today, you can buy a fraction of that through most stockbrokers. We've got zero commission with online brokers, so you don't have to pay to trade. We've got rampant speculation. This is particularly the case in the United States, but it's also the case in countries like India and China, where you've got a lot of people, because of lockdown, a lot of millennials becoming day traders. And they're not only just trading stocks and shares, they're trading options. And then we've got really low interest rates today. You know, we're at the zero lower bound. People can borrow to invest in the stock markets. People are reaching for yield. And so the three sides are present. We just need a spark. And these sparks are really difficult to predict. These are the unpredictable things. And this is where we hope the likes of my book and the likes of other new mental models help us try and figure out if there's a bubble around the corner, Vincent.
Caveat emptor, we have been warned. Fascinating stuff indeed. That was John Turner, Professor of Finance and Financial History at Queen's University Belfast and co-author of Boom and Bust, A Global History of Financial Bubbles. John, thanks indeed for joining us.
Thanks very much, Vincent, for having me.
Taking stock on News Talk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.